We have sympathy with Judge Key's concern and frustration, but I do not believe we can support a tax on security interest holders to address that concern. Ken has been able to go through the bill, and I know that you don't want all of his many pages of notes, but we'd like to give you a flavor if we could, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ken Sherman with the Oregon Bankers Association. Just really begun the process of trying to go through and figure out the amendments that have been offered and the interrelationship of those amendments to the larger bill. But we do have some concerns, and I think Frank has already alluded to the primary one, which is the question of whether the admittedly laudable purpose of taking from a person who is bent upon using a vehicle, notwithstanding the suspension under the circumstances described in the bill, whether the cost of that ought to fall upon the financial institution or rather ought to fall on society at large. Seems to me that what this really amounts to is a tax on the individual or the institution that happens to hold a security interest. And Judge Keyes alluded several times during his testimony to the fact that that cost would be substantial. I think he said at one point that it would be extraordinary. There is no question that if this state is going to adopt a mandatory forfeiture law that requires the seizure and forfeiture of motor vehicles under the circumstances described here, that there are going to be substantial costs. And we think that it ought to be very carefully considered whether it is appropriate to tax one element or group of society. And we're not just talking about financial institutions. We're talking about people who sell motor vehicles on contracts, and there are a lot of them out there other than financial institutions whose interests and rights need to be taken into consideration. It was also testified to, as I understood it, that this one of the reasons why we ought to do this as a separate procedure rather than just adding driving while suspended as an offense under the larger body of 2282 was that this would be a shorter process, that somehow that we could get through this process in a period of something like 10 to 60 days. And yet, as I read the amendments, and I guess I preface all my comments about the amendments with the thought that I haven't really had a chance to study them, and even if I did, I'm not sure I would fully understand them. But if I read them correctly, we've got a preliminary hearing before the Department of Motor Vehicles, and that is to be followed by a jury trial, if that's the desire of the vehicle owner. And as I understand it, in Multnomah County, they now have, and I guess they're developing in other counties as well, programs of mandatory arbitration to which the procedures we're talking about here would apply, so that we've really got three processes, three procedures. We've got the preliminary hearing, we've got mandatory arbitration, if that would apply, and I understand that the jurisdictional limit on that in Multnomah County is $25,000, then to be followed by a jury trial. It's hard for me to see how all of that is going to move more quickly, more expeditiously, and at less cost to whoever bears that cost than would the procedure outlined in the general bill. Section 38 of the amendments provides, as I understand it, that the holder of a security interest may, under the circumstances described in that section, obtain the release of the vehicle. One of the things apparently the holder would have to do is to supply the division with an affidavit that says that the security interest holder has a security interest and that the security interest loan is in default. So right now we know that this procedure only works if the loan is in default, and that the security interest holder is going to foreclose the security interest, and here's the one that bothers me, and that the security interest holder will not release the vehicle to the person who violated 811-182. Now, the problem that it seems to me that we have with that is that, as we all know, if a financial institution or any other party has a security interest in a piece of property, their rights to possess and hold that property are limited to the extent that there is a default. If, under this section, the vehicle is released to the security interest holder, here's the car, Mr. Bank, and then the owner of the vehicle comes in and pays the loan current. It wasn't default, but now it's not. Under the UCC and the other laws of the state relating to security interest, the security interest holder has no choice but to release that vehicle. So the long and short of it, it seems to me, is that under Section 38, we'd never have a release because you'd never have a security interest holder who could sign the affidavit that is required by this section.
On the point of whether something is or is not in default, I mean, if we by statute declare it to be in default, if it meets certain criteria, is that possible, not possible? I see Frank shaking his head.
I think it would not be possible, but the point of it is that that's not what Section 38 says. It
well,
says
let's pretend that it does.
Oh, okay.
Why would that not be possible?
You would change the law to say that the vehicle's been seized puts the security interest in default.
Yeah, let's say we statutorily declare it to be in default if it meets certain criteria. Can we do that? If not, why not?
Well, it seems to me that you can do in the statute anything you want in terms of saying that, but you've still got the problem that if the owner of the vehicle comes in with the money and
the point is we've statutorily said it's
Chair,
in default.
Madam Chair,
why
Minnis.
Can't we do that?
Representative Minnis, I understand. I think Mr.
Yeah.
Sherman understands the question.
Yeah.
I don't think he does.
Let's take another shot at it. Mr. Bronner.
Madam Chair, Representative Minnis, I think constitutionally you've got a problem if you do that with existing contracts.
That's what I want. I
you might be able to look prospectively and say that default DWS is automatic default. I suppose we could put it in our legal agreements in the future. And now that Ken, what do you think?
Well, once again, I think you probably could put language of that effect into the contract. But remember that Section 38 is to operate before there's been any kind of a hearing. So there's been no judgment that the person was in default, that the person violated the law. So it just seems to me that really doesn't hang together. And Section 38, which I understand was intended to help us with the problem by giving us early release, really doesn't help us at all. We simply can't meet the conditions that are outlined in that section.
Madam Chair, Representative Minnis, there's a case going to the Supreme Court now dealing with legislation that declared that interfered with existing contracts retroactive. I'd say it would take a long time to determine whether you could or could not. And what's more, it certainly doesn't meet the test of trying to protect everybody's rights.
Okay, another problem, I think, under the same section is subsection 1B, which would require the security interest holder to execute an agreement to hold the person who is in custody of the vehicle in the state harmless of all damages arising as a result of releasing the vehicle. It seems to me that we've got a real problem with that if it's later somehow determined through the forfeiture process, through the hearing and so forth that are set out in the bill, that the forfeiture or the seizure of the vehicle was improper, invalid. At that point, I assume, because the bill says so, that the owner of the vehicle would have a claim against the state for the recovery of the $100 penalty and the $20 a day and so forth. And we are promising here as a security interest holder that apparently we're going to hold the state harmless from those consequences. And that's obviously a blank check that I don't think any security interest holder is going to be willing to sign.
Mr. Sherman, I've got a question. Does this type of framework exist in any other state?
Not that I am aware of at all, Madam Chair. I've never seen a piece of legislation of this kind.
What would be the... Let's just say, for example, that I bought my car in Virginia and drove it to Oregon and got into all kinds of trouble in Oregon. Are we going to have to send out a notice so that Virginia car sellers and banks who do business with people who live in or relocate to the state of Oregon have to have this in their contracts as well? I mean, how do you work that when you have people who travel across state lines and, you know, relocate all the time?
Madam Chair, I think that is a major problem. Even for people who live in Oregon, they're dealing with nationwide financing people, GMAC and folks like that who are writing contracts that that apply across state lines. But certainly, your worst example would be that the situation where the vehicle was sold in the state of Virginia or some other state that is unaware of Oregon's laws and has not put language into its contract that would allow the security interest holder to seize the vehicle under the circumstances outlined in this bill. I think that is a real problem. Subsection 3 of this same section says that if a vehicle is released to a security interest holder under this section and the registered owner of the vehicle is eligible to avoid forfeiture, the registered owner may obtain release of the vehicle within 10 days after the request for release if the registered owner has paid the costs and fees and so forth. It seems to me that that conflicts with the section that I was just concerned about where the vehicle has been released to the security interest holder. The security interest holder, remember, had to sign an affidavit that says we will never, ever, under any circumstances, release this vehicle to the registered owner. And yet subsection 3 says that if the circumstances of subsection 3 apply, then the registered owner is entitled to the release of the vehicle. I don't think we can have it both ways, and I'm not quite sure who prevails in that situation. While we're talking about who prevails, I should also mention a very basic concern, which is what happens if the person who is driving this vehicle is stopped and is arrested both for driving while suspended and also for transporting drugs. In that case, we've got a violation of both the larger parts of HB 2282 and the new provisions in these Dash 10 amendments, and I'm not at all sure under which set of provisions the automobile and the interest in the automobile would be subject to forfeiture.
Can we backtrack for a moment?
Go ahead, Representative.
Thank you. That gets back around to the notion why there was this amendment which failed before, which talked about bringing in driving under the influence, then suspension sanctions under the 2282 format. Your rationale is, well, we need to have one standardized format, particularly with these overlap. Now, do you have any problems with 2282 as it's with the Dash 9 amendments in terms of procedure? Any problems of significance?
Madam Chair, Representative Mannix, no, we do not.
And you wouldn't have any problems if we amended it to include driving while suspended and their suspension was a result of conviction for DUIL?
That's correct. In fact, that's what we had proposed amendments earlier to the committee to accomplish just that.
Madam Chair, Representative Mannix, it's our belief that that is, in fact, what the Dash 9 amendments do. They preempt local ordinances and would speak to a DWS local ordinance and giving each local government the opportunity to adopt such an ordinance. But the process would be the same. And I understand Judge Key's concern that the process would not be equally administered when it comes to DWS. He has much more experience than I have as to how this is going to work.
Thank you.
I'm just, Madam Chair, kind of working my way through sequentially, and I'll try and highlight some of the other concerns that we have.
Representative Mannix.
It seems to me, and I can only speak for myself, that this hearing this afternoon has at least established for me that one of the basic reasons why we have these hearings. You've already given me great pause as to proceeding with the Dash 10 amendments as a package to add on to this bill without a lot of further reflection and consideration. I don't know how the other members of the committee feel, but I feel driven, too, to want to go ahead with the Dash 9 amendments and go ahead with the bill and see a hearing on 3371 to consider this as an alternative or supplemental or overlap being programmed. And Madam Chair, with deference to you, I'm just suggesting that I've probably heard enough to say I wouldn't vote for the Dash 10 amendments this afternoon as a package, and I'd consider them separately but not as part of this package.
Representative Mannix, I want to make it clear that at this point that I would like to entertain, I'd like the committee to, subcommittee to entertain the possibility, which I raised while Representative Kalori was still here, that I will work with the Speaker to obtain a hearing on 3371. I think at this point what we're doing is as you say, I think we're jeopardizing a lot of work that was done on House Bill 2282 for the sake of putting folding in something as an amendment, which is really a separate bill.
Madam Chair, responding to that?
But I also want to comment that the concerns that you're voicing are being that you're voicing, Representative Mannix, that have been drawn to your attention by Mr. Sherman and Mr. Braun are concerns that will exist to the other bill as well.
I recognize that. And I take you in good faith on the idea of attempting to set a hearing on 3371. I know you have to get the Speaker's permission, and that's certainly satisfactory to me, Madam Chair.
Would, Madam Chair, I don't want to waste the committee's time. We can reduce this to writing if we can proceed.
I don't think anybody has to reduce anything to writing here, although it might be helpful if the committee has decided to go ahead with House Bill 2282 and move the -9 amendments. My only recommendation at this point would be to take you up on something that was commented, and that is that 2282 might be a better bill if we add some language that we considered at our last hearing, which specifically refers to DWS.
Madam Chair.
And I think we've all got copies of that language. Representative Mannix.
At the appropriate time, I would be happy to offer that. I have it in front of me from the prior hearings. I'd also, at the appropriate time, I have one other amendment to deal with some funding for DEQ out of the cost, something that District Attorney Shrunk's office proposed and I've marked up and passed around, but I'll make those motions when you tell me it's an appropriate time.
I suppose Mr. Sherman and Mr. Bronner, it's up to you. Do you have anything further that you'd like to bring to the attention of the committee, Mr. Sherman, right now?
Well, at the risk, I really don't want to prolong this in terms of providing you with more detail, and we would be more than happy, once we've had a chance to go through this in greater care, to provide you with additional information in written form. I was about to mention that Section 40A, Sub 2, provides that a vehicle that has been seized may be sold at any time prior to forfeiture. The question that occurs to me in reading that is that what happens if that occurs and it is later determined through the hearings process and this three-step procedure that I described that the forfeiture or the seizure of the vehicle was not proper and that the forfeiture is invalid. I'm not quite sure how that individual, forget the security interest holder for a minute, the owner of the vehicle gets the vehicle back.
I'll be happy
to continue at your pleasure, Madam Chair. There are other problems of that nature that I can allude to, but I don't want to waste your time.
Madam Chair.
Representative Mannix, thank you, Mr. Sherman.
First, I would request that you reduce your comments to writing and share them with Representative Caloria and Judge Key so that they'd have a chance to evaluate your comments on that bill. And assuming that the Speaker can be prevailed upon and we have a hearing, then they would be apprised in advance of some concerns that you have that they can try to address.
Mr. Sherman, let me interrupt for a second. Representative Mannix, I want to make sure we have the famous level playing field here in front of the committee. Have you ever had a discussion about 3371 and raise these concerns with Representative Caloria or with Judge Keyes, or are these all first impression issues that you're bringing to us today?
I, Madam Chair, have had a couple of meetings with Representative Caloria and Judge Keyes. Unfortunately, they were focused on a measure that is much different than what we have here today.
Is 3371 much different from the -10 amendments?
Again, without having done a comparison, it's kind of hard to say, but my impression is that they're quite different, that the original printed version of the bill is a substantial departure. But I'm not the authority on that, and if others who have had a chance to compare them more closely would differ with that, I just haven't had a chance to look at it that closely. I know that what's in the -10 is substantially different than what we talked about in our earlier meetings.
Madam Chair, I move that we amend the bill with the -9 amendments. Where there are spaces in the -9 amendments for the insertion of the name of an account, that should include the Oregon State Police, account in the general fund, as the phraseology.
Representative Mannix, can you give us a little bit of history here on your motion?
Yes, and first of all, in terms of the name of the account, I just inquired during the break to get the name of the account that had been worked out. There were spaces left in this Legislative Council version because they weren't sure what the name of the account was, and now I know what it is. That's why I'm inserting that that language. I'm satisfied that there are a couple of other amendments I'm going to offer, but I'm satisfied that those -9 amendments take care of the vast majority of concerns and comments that we've heard since the earlier amendments were adopted to this bill. And they're blended in, as I understand it, from Council's description of those earlier amendments. Is my understanding correct, Mr. Taylor?
That's correct. Madam Chair, if I could just ask Representative Mannix one question.
Yeah. What was the name of that account again?
Oregon State Police Account in the General Fund.
Thank you.
21 and page 21 and 23 have got spaces for that.
My understanding, Representative Mannix, that the Governor's Office and the Attorney General's Office are in agreement on the -9 amendments.
That's my understanding also, Madam Chair.
It's also my understanding that in some portion of these, and I haven't had a chance to even take a look at this, but I'm finding it on page 22, that there is a distribution of that of those proceeds which are realized above the cost of the forfeiture enforcement proceeding.
I should add, Chair Bauman, that what I had done is I had read the materials that were submitted in support of that, and that's why I was comfortable in going ahead and just moving the amendments. I know we haven't had any live testimony. We just had the submission of documents today.
Oh, I appreciate that. Is there any discussion on the motion? Representative Mannix has moved the -9 amendments. The understanding is that the Department of Justice and the Governor's Office are in agreement, and these represent discussions that we've had in the committee. Is there any objection to the -9 amendments?
Madam Chair.
Representative Mannix.
Quick question.
Sure.
Once they're adopted, are we going to have the opportunity to listen to some remarks from the Governor's Office and from the Attorney General in regards to what they've agreed upon?
Well, the Governor's Office was here earlier. I don't know. There's no reason, Representative Mannix, for us to vote on them and then hear about them.
Well, I guess what I'm saying
is we could do it the other way around.
Yeah,
it's
I'd like to have some explanation of what they're doing.
Why don't you come up? Yeah. Kind of walk us through your amendments here.
Madam Chair, Representative Mannix. First, to make sure that the record is clear here today, 2289-9 represents 2282-6, which in turn represents all of the motions which and changes which were made by this subcommittee at its last meeting. The only difference between 2282-9 and 2282-6 is the addition of the material which I separately submitted under the heading of state distribution amendments this afternoon. It's the material that has the attached graphs that describe the effect of the formulas adopted in each of the two sections.
Well, let me ask you a question. Maybe it'll facilitate things. Does this, if we pass 2282-9 and that becomes the bill, is there a possibility that we're jeopardizing our ability to participate in the federal equitable share program?
Madam Chair, Representative Mannix, this was a question, or at least related questions were raised at the last hearing. I endeavored to get definitive answers to that question and to others, and have not yet been successful in doing so. I have provided the committee with the raw materials with which I'm working, and those are in the form of a memorandum from me to Mr. Taylor. My best answer to your question is if 2282-9 becomes law, I believe that we will be able to continue to share in equitable sharing. Where we have the greatest risk to adoptive seizures and equitable sharing is when the legislature mandates the expenditure of forfeiture proceeds for some purpose which departs from something which could be characterized as law enforcement. To the extent that there's a mandatory expenditure of funds on what might well be characterized as non-law enforcement purposes, then there's a risk to our ability to continue to share in equitable sharing. I believe that under the bill as drafted in 2282-9, that we will be able to continue to participate, perhaps in a more limited fashion, but certainly we will continue to participate in some cases with the federal government in equitable sharing. Understanding that this is my prediction of the behavior of the federal government, which is sometimes risky.
Okay, Madam Chair,
yes.
Following up those, where in the Dash 9 amendments are there any potential problems relevant to delineation?
Madam Chair, Representative Minnis, I would identify for the committee all of those sections pertaining to the purposes for which forfeited monies can be spent. Those are in Section 10, which has to do with distribution of money to cities and counties. And there, the provisions of the bill permit recovery as costs, the investigative expenses, including the attorney's fees that may be incurred by the local jurisdiction in securing the forfeiture. The latter is a category of expenditures which is a gray area under the federal guidelines for the use of federal equitably shared monies now. And I understand that in some cases those costs have been permitted to be paid from equitable shared monies, and in other cases they have not. I think as drafted, one can fairly read Section 10 as making that a use that the statute permits us to expend that money for, but it's not clear that the statute says in the mandatory sense that the federal government guidelines would view as mandatory that the money must be spent on attorney's fees. Furthermore, we have the argument that these are law enforcement related attorney's fees as drafted.
Representative Minnis.
Do we still have the language referencing methamphetamine lab cleanup? Is it in the Dash 9
amendments? Madam Chair, Representative Minnis, the Dash 9 amendments do not include any language with respect to meth lab cleanup costs.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair, with
Mr. Shepherd, a question about that, and this takes us a little bit afield of what your instant interest is, but is there anything in this structure that would prevent a local government, and now I'm really looking at the at this allocation, your interpretation of federal fund eligibility, that would prevent a local government from contributing for the cleanup of methamphetamine lab?
Representative Bauman, no. I do not see anything in the bill that would prevent a local government from voluntarily spending some of its money for that purpose. If the political subdivision is a county, then the bill simply specifies that the proceeds shall be used for criminal justice services and then lists some examples of those things, but the list is in terms of including enforcement and prosecution and so forth. So my reading of that language would be that the political subdivision could make its determination of what constituted a criminal justice service. If it wanted to stretch that and define it to include meth lab cleanup costs, I guess it could.
Where in the bill, do you find that language?
So on page 19, section 10, subsection 1C, with respect to cities, I believe they could follow the same kind of analysis, and if they chose to spend some of their forfeiture proceeds on meth lab cleanup, they could do so.
Would it be helpful in terms of directing some future county which had a question about whether this was permissible to specifically include methamphetamine laboratory cleanup? And if we state that conceptually, I'm sure that legislative council knows what we mean and can make it consistent with language that's elsewhere in ORS.
Madam Chair, if subsection C, if it was the intent of this committee to make clear that a local jurisdiction could spend forfeiture proceeds on meth lab cleanup, then one, I think, would want to amend or add that to the list of things, the permissive uses for which a local jurisdiction could spend forfeiture money. And if it were added as a permissive use, as opposed to a mandated expenditure, then I think we have the strongest possible argument that we can continue to participate in federal equitable sharing in appropriate cases.
Oh, is there a similar list for a city, or do we just find that in Section D if the political subdivision is not a county?
I believe it's in subsection D,
yeah.
And there's no similar restriction on the purposes for which cities may expend these cities may expend these monies. Madam Chair, I hate to keep saying to the committee that the Attorney General hasn't taken a position on all these interesting issues, but the committee will recognize that the interests of state law enforcement agencies are not directly impacted.